This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show for your St. Patrick's Day Wednesday. Matt, Brett, you know what that means, Brett?
Dermot?
Flynn. Dermot, you did talk to him earlier today, right?
I did, yep.
Very Irish.
Oh, to say the least, yeah.
Dermot will be joining us for his usual St. Patrick's Day update. And by the way, if you think you've had it tough for your pandemic, you got to hear what the Europeans are doing, man.
Yeah, he was telling me about that. He was sounded kind of surprised that we weren't under stricter lockdowns right now.
Yeah. Thanks, Republican Party. You know, heaven forbid we actually cherish human life over, I don't know, beer wings and $4 rail pitchers. It'd be great.
Well, we are dealing with the 19th strain of the coronavirus.
Yeah. Or COVID. 19th, yeah. It's our 19th strain. Thanks, Dr. Kiffmeyer. Stein as well. We have the Jeff song loaded, ready to go, right?
That's been stuck in my head all day. I'm not even kidding.
If we can only merge the Jeff song with some Irish music, there we go. We'd be set. But we got Stein coming up here in just a little bit, which means we are jam-packed. Hope you're having a wonderful day. Roads are a lot better because obviously we had the snow again last night. Did you hear anything about that snow we were supposed to get?
When I did the forecast, it said like maybe a half inch overnight, but as I was up a little bit later last night, it was coming down pretty hard. So
it was indeed coming down a little hard. It was, definitely a bit of a shocker this morning, but things are looking good there. I've got the corned beef going. Have had that going. Same thing. Onion, little garlic, one big beer, and then more onion, corned beef, about three quarters of the spice packet. And then just leave it 11 hours later, gold, pure gold. Plus, it's New England boiled dinner, and that's how I know it. I know it as New England boiled dinner, which is corned beef, cabbage, potatoes, and carrots. And I've got four pots going right now. Looking forward to this when I get home. I hope you have a wonderful St. Patrick's Day. Be safe out there. And if anything, as a guy who's traveled to Ireland numerous times, and the godparents of my kids are Irish, my dearest friends are some of them are Irish. And it is truly a wonderful culture. And if you get the chance to kind of enjoy yourself tonight, just kind of, be grateful for the health you have and what you have in life. By all means, that's about as Irish as you can get. 952-946-6205. So a lot to get to. I'm going to start off with the coronavirus update. I'll get to the Chauvin trial a little bit later on. The last I checked, one last juror they were checking. They did... they did see one more juror today after some of them got let go. Unicorn Riot, like I said, they've been doing a great job keeping on top of this, and they're like breaking news far better than, frankly, than anyone else I know right now in the metro area that's doing this. So do they have an update on that? All the rest of the jurors were heading home for the day. The 83 was excused. I think they were on 85 was the last I checked. All the new jurors are being sent home for the day, except for potential juror 85, who's going to be sworn in question right now. So that's the last juror they're going to check on. That was about 42 minutes ago. We'll see if that juror got seated. But at the same time, once again, it's just a, we'll get an update on that coming up after Dermot in the 5 o'clock hour. I got to start, though, with the news of a member of Governor Tim Walz's staff has tested positive for COVID-19. His office said in a statement, the first-term DFL governor who has not been vaccinated, and I'll get back to that in a second, will quarantine along with Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan, who has had one of the two-dose Moderna vaccine. Department of Health Commissioner Jan Malcolm was also at a Monday press event where the exposure occurred and will also quarantine. Walz, Flanagan, Malcolm, and staff at the event will quarantine until March 25th, which is 10 days after the exposure. Teddy Shan, the governor's press secretary, said the incident shows the pick is still ongoing. The governor hopes this serves as an important reminder for Minnesotans that while we're close to the end of the pandemic, we must continue to take COVID-19 seriously, wear a mask, social distance, get tested, and sign up to get vaccinated. All right, this is going to be my first thing I've really kind of had a big problem with Walz on. How in the hell are you not vaccinated, sir? With all due respect, how are you not vaccinated? And I understand what you're saying is that you might not be in the prime demographic. And I know the Republicans who quietly are getting their vaccines out of the spotlight, many of them quietly will, if you get vaccinated, will quickly come on out and criticize you. That's the reality is you're the senior executive of the state of Minnesota. You need to be vaccinated, sir. This was a mistake. You should have been vaccinated, at least the Johnson & Johnson one doser, okay? So I have to admit, I'm a little bit flummoxed that I understand you want to tough it out. You want to lead by example, but you need to lead. And right now, this is not leading if you're all of a sudden quarantined again. And God forbid you or the lieutenant governor or Jan Malcolm gets sick. I mean, that's not good. And we've already seen the damage that this illness can do as it ran through the Republicans who basically flouted your coronavirus restrictions and ended up they likely killed one of their own senators. So, you know, by all means, you need to get vaccinated. And as soon as you're God willing, you basically get through this quarantine, no problem, and then you get vaccinated right away. Enough with the games. You're a priority because you're the senior executive of the state. Nearly 2 million COVID-19 vaccine shots have been administered in Minnesota against an infectious disease that has been found in 499,962 people in the state and caused 6,756 deaths. Wednesday's increase means that 23% of Minnesotans who have received at least the first dose of the COVID-19 vaccine, including 76% of senior citizens who have suffered 89% of the state's deaths. Of the 1,284,612 people 16 and older who have received vaccine, 746,829 have completed the series, either by receiving the two doses or the single Johnson & Johnson dose. The state director of infectious diseases, Chris Eicherman, urged people to schedule and receive timely second doses of the vaccines, which are supposed to be given 4 and 3 weeks respectively after the first doses. As more people become eligible, we know it may be harder for some to complete this vaccination series. Vaccine is prioritized right now in Minnesota for healthcare workers, educators, senior citizens, long-term care residents, and non-elderly adults with certain underlying health conditions or frontline occupations that present high risk for viral exposure. Those groups account for an estimated 3.5 million Minnesotans and the majority of the state's adult population. So, you know, and I don't qualify. I want you guys all to get out there. I'll get mine eventually, hopefully. But you need to get working on that. Long-term care residents are among the first to be prioritized because nursing homes and other facilities were hit hard by COVID-19. By the way, that list should also, I think we can all agree, that list should probably include governors. Yeah, governor and the governor. We can get you a dose of the Johnson & Johnson. For the governor. Wasn't he at the thing they did at the Vikings complex? When they launched the Johnson & Johnson single dose? Like, wasn't he there?
I think he was.
Okay.
I get there would be some political concerns, but it's one vaccine. It's not like he's taking away thousands of vaccines that others could be getting.
And sorry, if Gazelka wants to make how come the governor is running to the front of the line? Because he's the governor. He should have gotten vaccinated. The state on Wednesday reported another 7 COVID-19 deaths in Minnesota. and 1,046 diagnosed infections. Health officials continue to closely watch an outbreak that centered on youth sports activities in Carver County because it was involved in more infection variant of the coronavirus that prompted a COVID-19 waves after it emerged in Europe. And I, as a matter of fact, I was talking to a friend of mine this morning, Steve, and I were chatting. And he is one of these people who's like, will, you know, El Commandant Walls kind of take the foot off the brakes at this point? And I said, the problem is that every time he does, you have people who are screwing up. And we talked about this yesterday. What do you mean you have to put new rules in place about team dinners and team sleepovers? Come on. That is, you know, if you are lucky enough to get your sports season back, you have to make at least the meekest of concessions, such as not having a team dinner and not having a team sleepover. And I know there are going to be some parents, but Matt, that's team building. You know what also would be team building, I guess, in your book? All of you being on the same hospital floor as you suffered through this. For goodness sakes, come on. You have to make some concessions if you're going to have this happen. And this is the problem, is that every time you open this stuff up a little bit, there are people out there that, hey, pandemic's over, and they are not taking it seriously. We are going to break 500,000 cases tomorrow in the state of Minnesota in a population of 5.5 million. Even though we're still better than a lot of states in this country, we still are just, that is obscene. And that's with a good governor, not like the coronavirus buffets over in the Dakotas, for God's sakes. I understand it's frustrating. No one likes this. Do you think anyone likes wearing a face mask, socially distancing, not seeing loved ones, not being able to have an Easter get together? Or go on out and have a few pints of Guinness tonight for St. Patrick's Day. We all want this opened again, but just because we have our own personal desires doesn't mean it's not like with Lent. I've talked about the Friday fish fries with Lent. I'm not kicking open some church's door and saying, you need to get your volunteers in here now and get me a Friday fish dinner I can eat right here like normal. Because I'm not a selfish jackass. No one wants to be like this. No one does. And as long as as long as Walls keeps opening this stuff up and, you know, people keep failing spectacularly, well, guess what? And as a matter of fact, a new outbreak of COVID-19 has prompted a high school in East Central Minnesota to immediately move back to distance learning and forcing the boys' basketball team to cancel its season just as the playoffs began. Oh, yes, because the most important thing is the boys' basketball season. Pine City High School, which returned to full in-person learning on March 1st, is back to the distance learning model Wednesday after recognizing an outbreak that has so far resulted in 9 students testing positive for the disease and approximately 90 more students in quarantine. In a letter to parents, Superintendent Dr. Kurt Trygestad, Trygstead, said the high school is experiencing what is perhaps the most pervasive outbreak of COVID-19 to date. We moved from 0 cases to at least 9 cases in 3 days. We expect more confirmed cases in coming days, T-Dog wrote. Principal Troy Anderson informed T-Dog that positive tests and exposures have pushed the school's levels of distance learnings from 100 to about 250, including 50 athletes. That's more than one-third of the school's enrollment. T-Dog also said that it's most concerning that the county's inability to connect the dots when contact tracing means there's an unidentified community transmission happening. So, that's Pine County, where we all remember Robin Cole, the Pine County Sheriff, pew, 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 who is sitting there telling him, ain't no President Obama going to tell me how to run this county. Pa-ding! Yeah, that place, you know, Idiot Central, apparently, because the county is, and I guess the county's like, you know, tracking where kids are getting sick, you know, that's what communists do. That's commie talk. Things get really bad. Will the state come up and help us? We're needy. Yeah, I guess we'll have to. because the county can't take care of themselves. Ugh. County's inability to connect the dots when contact tracing. Public health believes that there may be a person or persons who are attending when not feeling well or asymptomatic. We just don't know, T-Dog said. In the past, we've had been able to identify and isolate those affected by using contact tracing. This time, there are not common threads other than those affected in the Pine County students. The outbreak has forced the Pine County boys basketball team to cancel the season. The Dragons were 13-5 of the regular season champions of the Great River Conference. They were scheduled open with section playoffs Thursday against Sauk Center. The game has been forfeited, effectively ending their season. Pine City High School will remain in distance learning through March 26th. March 26th? Yeah, like 10 days, okay. The school is on spring break March 29th through April 2nd. The district plans to return high schoolers to in-person learning on Tuesday, April 6th. The outbreak in Pine City follows the situation that's unfolding in Carver County, where the UK variant has led to dozens of cases and an alert from state health officials to do everything possible to limit transmission and of the more contagious strain. But right now in Carver County, where it from what I've understood, what's happened in Carver County has kind of leaped from just what is going on in the schools and with the athletic teams down there to now it's county. It's becoming more prevalent throughout the entire county. You got to lock down in Carver County right now. You got to go back to where we used to be. If you're going to keep this at bay. Some positivity with the vaccines, some negativity, a real big negative story with the governor now back in quarantine. You got to be careful, people. This is not over. It's not even close to being over. It's not even close to being over. And if you start doing victory laps when the race is not even halfway done, well, guess what? You're not going to win. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. When come on back, I got to get to just ugly, ugly, ugly Republicans. We'll talk about that when I come back in a moment. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. Matt Brett here today. Stein coming up here in about 6 minutes. Senate Republicans want the state of Minnesota to restore the statue of Christopher Columbus torn down by a group of demonstrators last year to its former spot on the Capitol campus. What? The state Senate Government Committee voted on Wednesday to repair and return the statue, though lack of support from DFLers at the Capitol makes it unlikely to happen this year. Senator Bill Ingebrigtsen of Alexandria noted that the statue, first erected in 1931, was an initiative to the state's Italian-American community, which at a time had often faced discrimination. He said it would cost about $154,000 to put it back up. You know, the funny story, Ingebrigtsen, the Italian community was being discriminated by guys like with names like Ingebrigtsen. I don't know if you're aware of that. And Christopher Columbus was also used as a weapon, especially in northern cities, which didn't want to put up Confederate statues, to basically, you know, as a way to, you know, of overseeing the minority communities, particularly the Native American communities. It was a way for them to basically rub that racist past in their face, but they did it under the argument of Italian pride. So, yeah. This is public property, said Ingebrigtsen, who's sponsoring the measure. Everyone in the state of Minnesota owns this, and everybody in the state of Minnesota can come and see this. There should be a push to remove our history here in Minnesota and our country, and quite frankly, that's the wrong direction. Okay? Once again, you're an idiot, Bill, because you think statues are how we learn about history. And if that's the case, do you have a Hitler statue someplace? Because how in the world would we know about World War II and Adolf Hitler if not for a statue? See, that's the problem. And by the way, everyone in the state of Minnesota owns this. No, if you try to put this damn statue back up, you jackass, you are going to own this. Because you know what this feels like to me? This feels like Senator Bill Ingebrigtsen grabbing Native Americans by the nape of the neck, thrusting their face into Christopher Columbus's statue and saying, you have to like this. No, they don't. And they've got a lot of good reasons why they shouldn't. A Columbus shipmate, Miguel Cuneo, wrote that when our caravels were to leave for Spain, we gathered 1,600 male and female Indians on February 17th, 1495. And we let it be known that any of the sailors who wanted to take them could do so. Cuneo took a teenage Caribbean girl as a gift from Columbus. And when she resisted, he thrashed her mercilessly and raped her. Speaking of rape, it's noted by University of Vermont history professor Dr. James Lowen that as soon as the 1493 expedition got to the Caribbean, Columbus was rewarding his lieutenants with native women to rape. On Haiti, sex slaves were one more prerequisite that they enjoyed. It included adult rape and child rape. As Columbus himself wrote in 1500, girls from age 9 to 10 are in demand. In one day, De La Casas wrote, Columbus soldiers dismembered, beheaded, or raped 3,000 natives. As a result, De La Casas wrote, my eyes have seen these acts so foreign to human nature that I now tremble as I write. That's the guy that Bill Ingebrigtsen thinks we need to put a statue up to, because I guess Bill Ingebrigtsen wants everyone to look up to the guy that talked about girls from the age of 9 and 10 are in high demand for sex slaves. Columbus has a history that should be remembered. And it's not this whitewashed version, this schoolhouse rock. Hey, guess what? We're just looking for a trade route. It should be, hey, he was looking for a trade route, but when he got to the Caribbean, he basically became one of the worst monsters in the history of the planet, enslaving hundreds of thousands of people, wiping out native tribes to the Caribbean without any question of it. And in a day when white people look down upon the natives in these communities, even they were dumbfounded and aghast and horrified by what Columbus was doing to the native peoples. Bill Ingebrigtsen, he feels it's important to put that guy's statue back up and make Native Americans respect it. I'm disgusted by you, sir. I am disgusted you would even think about bringing that statue back up. But by all means, if any Democratic senator, if this gets to a House floor discussion, if you want the documentation, I'll give it to you, and you can remind Senator Ingebrigtsen of exactly what he is championing, exactly what he thinks is a good guy that deserves a statue at our state capitol. We have plenty of people in Minnesota history that you could put up there in a statue. Native Americans, African Americans, Latino, Asian, Hmong, white. But you going out of your way and going out there and demanding it be put back up in a place of honor is so disturbing. That how else are we supposed to take it, Bill, outside of you trying to grab the nape of the neck of the Native Americans, thrust it in the face of Christopher Columbus, and say you have to respect him? How else are we supposed to take it, sir? How else are we supposed to take it? You disgusting pig. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Stein, hopefully when we do return, it is the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. We got Jeff? Oh, do we have the Jeff song? Oh, we got the Jeff song. There.
Jeff.
I don't.
Jeff.
If this doesn't play, I don't know what time it is, man.
J-E-F-F, Jeff.
Yes.
J J-E-F-F Jeff.
Who's up next?
J-E-F-F Jeff, Jeff, Jeff.
It's Jeff Stein.
Jeff, Jeff, Jeff.
I thought it was Jack Rice until I heard that song.
That's the J-A-C-K song. Okay. All right. We this is the way we keep it going here. Jeff Stein is our national and presidential expert. He is a noted author. You can find his books at Next Chapter Books, totallyiowa.com. The Iowa Business Report is the show he does down in Iowa, as along with the Iowa Politics Report, where he does at KXEL, Cedar Falls, Waterloo. Hey, Jeff.
See, I thought maybe you were off because of daylight saving time and it was just going to play at a different hour. I was confused, too, so that's good.
We got Dermot Flanagan from Ireland coming up next hour, and that's that we got a nice Irish jig that spells out Dermot. So, you know, it's what we have to do nowadays.
Well, we just talked off air about the song being in our heads every Wednesday, and then it didn't play. And I thought, well, now I'm just confused.
Well, welcome. That's why I need the song. Okay, let's start off with the Democrats finally calling Mitch McConnell's bluff. Let's just be honest here. I mean, McConnell has used the filibuster. I know that in the times we've talked about what McConnell's machinations within the Senate, that, you know, well, Joe Biden suggested he didn't hold up Supreme Court seats during election years. He just suggested it. And then basically everyone said, well, you see, it's the Biden standard, even though he never did it. And McConnell just labeled it as that. And then, of course, they reversed the Biden standard himself and quickly replaced the Supreme Court placed RBG's Supreme Court seat last year. You know, right. It is kind of one of those things where it's, you know, he's used the system to a T by basically abusing the credit of the system and then threatening anyone that tries to do it like he does. And the Democrats are finally, the argument is, well, we're going to shut down, if you get rid of the filibuster, we're going to close down the Senate. And the first thing the person said was, well, isn't that what we kind of doing already? So this is an empty bluff.
Mitch McConnell is expert at the empty bluff. I mean, he, this is the thing that I find fascinating. He's not loved by the right. He's obviously not loved by the left. I'm trying to see where his constituency is. You know, he was behind in his reelection effort until Trump endorsed him, and then he wound up winning, and then McConnell showed his loyalty, if you will, or thanks, by throwing Trump under a bus and driving over him multiple times, and that was before January 6th. Look, McConnell saying, if you don't keep things the way they are, if you try to mess around with the filibuster, you're going to destroy the sanctity of the Senate, etc. Check the mirror, Mitch, because I mean, it's so hollow. I mean, he didn't carry through with threats when he had the power. How in the world are we to take any of his threats seriously now that he doesn't have the power? I don't know why there hasn't been an internal challenge within that caucus, but there hasn't.
Well, and the reality is because he knows how to play the moderate Democrats, and he's done that very well. And under the guise, but I mean, I'm still, I mean, there's another bluff. Oh, hey, if you're with us, we won't be so mean on the election cycle. Of course they're mean on the election cycle, but still moderate Democrats. It's the old narrative I put forward that the Democrats are all in one big field and the moderate Democrats are close to a fence. And on the other side are the Republicans but the rest of the Democrats are way on the other side of the field. And so the feeling they have is, well, I'm closer to those guys than those guys. And they don't understand is the guys on the other side of that fence want to kill them. And so, you know, it's just, it finally seems that, and Manchin was the linchpin here. He sort of said, I wouldn't mind it going back to what it used to be, which is if you want a filibuster, well, then you got to get down there and start talking. And I think considering the age of a lot of Republicans, that kind of scared them a little bit.
Well, at the very least, it's a matter of, the filibuster, as we all learned it in school, is somebody gets up and reads the phone book. I mean, we know this. Look at the system we have now, where you have, this is tangential, but I think related, you've got Senator Ron Johnson saying, excuse me, I want you to read that 629-page stimulus bill, and then these poor clerks have to go grab a bunch of throat lozenges and read it. Was he there the whole 10 hours? I doubt it. Was anybody there? I mean, it's just become a farce. And so if you want to do a filibuster and you want to control the floor, then grab yourself that phone book and make sure it's double, because the rest of it is just a fiction of saying, okay, so if you invoke this clause, then that automatically delays it 12 hours. All right, we'll all go home, then we'll come back, and then you'll do it again. It's gamesmanship, and it's what makes citizens just sick of the whole thing.
Correct me if I'm wrong. There was, I can't remember. I think it was under Truman. There was a case where the opposing party was using the filibuster, and they kept filibustering it. And eventually, but gradually, what happens is, yeah, after a week of this, you know, these games, finally they caved and said, fine, I guess we can't stop it. And the bill got passed. I think that was the case. That was like one of the longest filibusters. And it was basically, it was a series of filibusters that happened.
Right.
But that's the real thing is that they already know that, you know, no one wants to listen to Ted Cruz and Rand Paul constantly go on. And the reality is for the American people, the worst thing you can have is a Ron Johnson or McConnell himself coming on out there and reading every Dr. Seuss book.
And as far as I'm concerned, if you're going to do it, then do it. I mean, and that's what you're saying. I mean, for example, I took advantage of the moment while you were talking to look, and the longest filibuster by a single person in history. Oh, this is a good one. Strom Thurmond filibustering the Civil Rights Act of 1957 when he was a Dixiecrat, 24 hours, 18 minutes. Okay, but at least he did it. You know what I mean? In terms of the way we're doing this these days is like filibuster light. You know, but I don't want it to actually have to adversely impact my little life. It's ridiculous. And so, but again, to get somebody like McConnell, I mean, to make the claims that he makes, you know, again, he didn't use the power when he had it. He certainly doesn't. And it's so lame to see him talk about how he's, you know, he'll do this and he'll do that. He can't do diddly squat. By the way, longest filibuster in history. Democrats held the longest filibuster in history, 75 days, 1960.
1960 what? Do we lose him there?
Yeah, it looks like we lost him. I'll try to reconnect with him.
Are you back here?
I didn't leave.
Okay.
I'm still here.
What year was that? When was there?
64.
64.
64. Civil Rights Act.
Well.
Okay, that's the longest continuous debate in Senate history. But the point is, they don't commit. They don't want to commit to actually doing it, with the thought being that maybe it could force some changes in the bill. It's all for C-SPAN at this point, and it is so, so hollow.
Do you think that the change with the moderate Democrats came about with the stimulus bill, namely the $15 minimum wage? And the reality is that they realize their power there is, you know, we can get this thing. I don't have to vote for this. And if they don't have my vote, it's not going to pass. And so we can get rid of the filibuster. Just because we do doesn't mean an agenda that necessarily a super progressive agenda that Manchin doesn't agree with is going to pass. And he still gets the benefit of being that the moderate when he goes back to West Virginia. Do you feel as if that whole circumstance with the $15 minimum wage kind of set this idea up with the moderates?
You know, here's the thing. Joe Manchin is the most popular guy in Washington right now. Right. Because he is the linchpin for Chuck Schumer. There's absolutely no doubt. And he's going to use that like any good politician would use it. The thing. So, yes, he can say, look, I can't abide by this particular provision, but let's pull that off and come revisit it another day. Because fact of the matter is, you might pull a Republican or two over if it's just a $15 minimum wage. And so you might not even need Manchin. I mean, this is a much broader game, right, that's being played. The thing that shows you how out of touch McConnell and his ilk are, they're making a big public statement about the sacred filibuster because they know it's something we learned in school. How dare these Democrats get rid of the filibuster? Okay, but the reality is it's meaningless. Because the key, as you accurately note, is one guy from West Virginia who made it very clear this week that he holds Robert Byrd's seat and knows that. He also knows the voting percentage in his state. He's not going to do anything that he shouldn't do. And it's given others who are in similar situations, especially as 2022 comes about. And that's an excellent point on your part. It's empowering those people to put some brakes on to say, look, I won't be here next time if you go too far. So you're going to have to work with me. And that's why I thought it was so dumb. Republicans thinking they could get Manchin to flip party affiliation. You remember that conversation?
Oh, yeah.
Holy cow. This is no Jim Jeffords situation. Well, it's crying out loud.
You said something there, though, I think is actually a very good point to know about the filibuster, is that the filibuster, for what it's become, allows the Republicans to get everyone to vote into unison. And without that filibuster, that ability to hold together the Republican Party starts becoming a lot harder, because you could always look back to the party as a whole to defend you. But now if it gets out there and it's individual votes, especially a Republican in a moderate state or a Democratic state, all of a sudden you don't have the loyalty that the filibuster forced upon the Republican Party.
The Republicans have, at least in this modern era, and for that matter, I'll say 25 years.
Okay.
They have had a very hard time keeping a coalition together. Democrats don't. You get Chuck Schumer out there and people say, wow, how'd you keep your coalition together? And he pulls his flip phone out of his pocket, famous for a flip phone, I'm not being derogatory, and says, this, I make a lot of calls. And so they can get their 50 whipped into shape, whipped as in they're whipping up the votes. That's why we have whips in the House. But the Republicans, no. I mean, at best, it's herding cats. And they proved it when they were in the majority, and it's not going to be any better now that they have 50 as opposed to 52 or 54.
And exactly, because, you know, the filibuster, you need 60. So sure, Murkowski or Collins wants to vote along with them. It still is not enough, and they can say, well, I tried, but now all of a sudden without that filibuster to keep them safe, now all of a sudden they have to make that vote. And that's going to be interesting to see where this goes from here, because I think McConnell definitely needs the filibuster far more than the Democrats do when they're in a minority situation.
Oh, I think that's right. I think that's exactly right. And this is the thing that's so disingenuous. And it's the same thing now when you're talking about the House Republicans and earmarks. What in the blazes? Does anybody stand for anything? I mean, where you stand depends on where you sit. The Republicans for years said no earmarks, no earmarks. They're the worst thing known to personkind, unless we're in the minority, in which case, yes, let's have earmarks. What is this all about? No wonder it's a rudderless group.
Well, you know who has committed? That one representative from Guam who showed up at Marjorie Taylor Greene's office with a basket of cookies and a whole bunch of National Guard guys from Guam, which was brilliant, by the way. I thought a lovely gesture. And she throws a fit to the Pentagon saying they were storming my office. What a pathetic snowflake she is.
Well, here's the thing, and not on my radio program in Iowa, but I filled in on some national programs, and I've had the occasion to talk with her that they had booked her as a guest. Not a lot going on, but what I thought was okay, so when they're going to have the whatever the vote was, and she puts a sign up saying there are only two genders, male and female, and then her neighbor across the hall hangs up the rainbow flag. Okay, fine. If we want to turn our offices into the front door of elementary school classrooms where we just kind of put up little decorations, okay, fine. But here's the thing. If you're going to put the one sign up, don't take offense that the other one puts the contrary view up. Isn't that the whole point of the free speech? You're putting yours up, so she puts a flag up. Where's the complaint? But apparently she didn't like that. I don't get it. I mean, if you're going to give, you're going to get. That's kind of how the discourse goes.
We'll take a break right now. When we come on back, I want to turn our attention towards what happened down in the Atlanta area and the shooter here, and actually talk a little bit about the media, because I'm a little shocked at how this is being described, and I'm very shocked about that police officer's description of the shooter. Jeff Stein's joining us, 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. Jeff Stein, kind enough to join us for his usual weekly visit, talking politics and national news. And Jeff, let's turn to the national news on the shooting that happened outside of Atlanta. Aaron Long of Woodstock, Georgia, enters into what is a spa, a massage parlor, shoots four there, kills four, actually shot five. I think one person there went to the hospital. Then drives quite a distance down closer to the Atlanta metro area, enters another a spa, massage parlor, shoots three people there, goes across the street, shoots another person there. They catch him as he's heading for Florida with the feeling that he might have been aiming for more attacks on this. You know, first, your thoughts on this, because obviously another case of gun violence erupting in America that is, just a sad, sad story.
Well, it is, and you've got someone who police believe is motivated by sex addiction as opposed to anything else. Now, I have a harder time going along with that when you see that the profiles of those who were injured or killed seem to lean very heavily toward one nationality. But again, all right. So he says, this is what I found interesting. Officials say, well, he said it's not racially motivated. Well, what is the guy going to say who just blew away a bunch of Asian women? He's going to say that it was because of... No, he's not. I mean, that struck me.
Well, and there is a part of this which just... This is... I am very perplexed by the media on this. He was targeting spas with Asian employees. It was clearly making the case already race related. It is, he was targeting Asians, regardless of whether you want to acknowledge that or not. He was. Right. The only question is, was there another motivation here? Because the way I put it out earlier was, if a shooter went into three different ice arenas, opened fire on three different hockey games, no one would be asking if the shooter was targeting hockey players. Of course they are. It clearly was, especially when you look at the distance he drove to the second shooting location. He was targeting Asian women and Asian workers, and clearly this is a racial thing. Why are the police and the media, if it's clear to everyone else what's going on here, why are they still refusing to kind of, call what it is?
Well, and I think it's a very interesting point that you raise, because they have him denying it. All right. It is, I suppose, plausible to say that he frequented these places all within a certain district, that he claims he was trying to remove temptation because he was a sex addict. I suppose you could say it was that there was a different common denominator, namely that they all worked at these rather explicit establishments. But here's the thing. I suppose maybe the authorities don't want it to, quote, merely be a racial attack. In other words, we can dismiss it because, oh, it's a racial attack. This guy was crazy and it was a racial attack. If there really is something broader to it, well, we don't want to diminish that aspect of it because it might teach us about how to prevent future such incidents. Now, I'm giving them a lot of credit that I don't know is deserved, but that's to your very clear question. Why in the world would they downplay the racial aspect? And my response is, okay, they may really believe there's something broader there, and they're afraid that people will simply just dismiss it as an attack on Asians, absent some other evidence. I don't have a good answer beyond that.
Well, I mean, the media, I think, sometimes has become, to a point as, a bit of trying to find the crossfire, middle of the road, both sides. And I don't think they want to call it what it clearly is. But I think that sometimes, like with the police, though, it's if they know that, oh, well, my gosh, who's been making fun and mocking Asian people for the last year? Well, Donald Trump is. Well, I'm a big Republican. I'm a sheriff here in a Republican county. If all of a sudden I go on out there and say, yeah, this was race related, this person targeted the Asians, I'm afraid that the public will come back and attack me because I'm just pointing out reality. I think it has a lot more to do with that than the fact that there's always politics in this country, and that the politics is weighing on the fact that you can obviously say this man targeted Asian women. You can obviously say that, But yet there's most of the media is refusing to say that, and most of the law enforcement involved is. It does sound like the FBI is involved, and they're looking at it under a much more, I guess you'd say, rational microscope at this point.
Well, and here's the thing. If you're the investigating officer, there are two commonalities. One is, well, there are three. One is gender, one is race, one is occupation. And so the guy is claiming, well, no, it's not racial, it's this. Okay, I don't know how you can deny certain facts. And the fact is it was against women. It was against predominantly Asian women, and it was against all of these people who worked at this location. I don't know why they're spinning it the way they are. I'm not prepared to say it's political and they're afraid of ramifications, because frankly, I don't know if this guy really is a whack job to where, you know, he had a thing against Asian women. You'd think he'd go spouting off about it. So I don't know. I'm not prepared to say there's a political aspect, because I still would like to think there are enough law enforcement officers in this country who would simply state facts and not let that intervene.
Although the one police officer today said, oh, the shooter had a really bad day yesterday. Really? Oh, wow. Yeah. I mean, I couldn't believe that.
Really bad day. I'm surprised he didn't say, well, yeah, he was in a bad mood, but boy, he's a good shot. You know, well, I mean, come on. That's about as insensitive. He had a really bad day.
Exactly.
As opposed to families of the deceased.
I would be remiss if I didn't point out another white guy shoots a lot of people with guns. They take him alive. How many African Americans? No gun. And that ends up with a much more tragic ending.
I have no opinion. I mean, I don't know enough about how they apprehended him. I think they pulled over a vehicle.
Yeah.
But they also did not shoot at that vehicle, did they?
No, they did not. Jeff, thank you very much. I appreciate this. We're going to spotlight this. I'll get the Iowa politics report out. Happy St. Patrick's Day to you, Jeff. Have a good one, okay?
Thank you, Matthew. Have a good one.
Take care. We're back. Dermot Flanagan joins us to begin hour number two right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show, hour number two on St. Patrick's Day. I hope you're doing well out there. Obviously, some sunshine right now in the Palatial Broadcasting Complex here in Eden Prairie. So the snow is melting. A tradition for us on St. Patrick's Day is to go over to Ireland itself and talk to Dermot Flanagan. This is a dear friend of mine, the godfather of my children. He is a lawyer on the outskirts of Dublin, Ireland, and he's kind enough today to join us once again to talk about how all things Irish on St. Patrick's Day. Hey, Dermot.
Hi, Matthew. Happy St. Patrick-ish Day.
St. Patrick-ish. Because you said it's today for you. It's a very different day. It's like nothing you've seen before.
No, it's the second Patrick's Day in lockdown, which for us is a complete lockdown. 5 kilometer radius, you can travel. Shops closed, pubs closed, everything closed except the essentials. So effectively, it's nothing happening here whatsoever.
I want to go back to something you just said here, because in the United States, there's a lot of people that feel as if they can only get their food to go from a restaurant and not sit down, that's a massive sacrifice. You put out the 5K radius comment. Talk about that, because in Ireland, you really can't go more than 5K from your house, right?
Yeah, well, the strict rule is, and it is policed, you're not supposed to go more than 5K from your house. Now, it's policed very liberally. There are police on the roads today checking. They don't pull over everybody. If they do pull over, they'll ask, look, where are you going? Have you a reason to be there? What they're really looking for are people heading off to congregate in large groups, probably younger people, parties, etc. But it is policed, and for the most part, people are adhering to it. There's a willingness, I'd say, by the vast majority of people just to put up with this until we can get vaccinated. So yeah, it's a strict imposition. It's certainly restricted movements for the last 6 weeks ago. This lockdown started, and it's going to continue at least at this level until the beginning of April, where it'll drop from level 5 to level 4. Now that will remove the 5K, but it will come with a condition that we restrict our movements, self-restricting, unless absolutely necessary. So it's we expect to be in this kind of position until probably the end of July.
And for everyone out there, 5K is 3.1 miles. So basically, you got 3 miles in any direction you can go, and that's it. You are basically stuck in that circle. What happened a few weeks back? Why did the country of Ireland go to this more severe lockdown?
Well, we opened up at Christmas for a 2.5 week period, opened up fully. And what happened was, you know, people went home, joined the holidays, did everything you would do during the holidays, and the infection rates went through the roof. They just went very high. And to put that in context, we have 280 fully staffed ICU, intensive care unit beds in the country. Now, there is a 400 capacity, but 280 fully staffed is how you refer to them. So at the moment, we have 83 people with COVID in ICU units. And it's all about managing hospitalizations. You know, if COVID were to take over the hospitals, then your cancer patients and all the other patients would be affected. So the lockdown is looked at as a way of controlling how many people go into ICU as much as anything else, because it's all about controlling hospital capacity. And that's what it's been since last March. The deaths, we've 4,500 deaths in the country with COVID related. Most of them would be over the age of 85. And arguably, you know, COVID was an addition to whatever conditions they perhaps already had. But it's always with the one eye on hospitalizations. We can't afford to overwhelm the medical services. Mm-hmm. So, and that's what happened basically at Christmas. It started becoming overwhelming because we opened up too quickly.
For everyone out there, because Ireland and Minnesota, we're about the same size, really, as far as your country.
And there's a lot of movement in and out of Ireland in any year, in any given basis.
In Minnesota, we've had 6,756 deaths, and actually, we're one of the better states. We are. Tomorrow for sure, we're going to hit 500,000 people in the state have been sick. How many total people in the country of Ireland have been sick? Do you know?
228,000 contracted the virus to date. We have about a 3.8% positivity rate, about 3.8% per 100,000.
Okay. What did we lose him there again? Oh, Skype, you're just a delight.
Yeah, I'll see if I can connect with him off air here.
Yeah. When you compare those numbers, it is a case where comparatively, they're probably pretty similar to the to Minnesota as far, it may be a little bit better as far as the deaths per 100,000, but they're far better than we have been in regards to the cases. They've not, and the reason why is because of that. And I want, like I said, I want people to realize and to understand that, yes, that is a really harsh, strict standard that they have had there, that whole limited amount of distance that they can have. But at the same time, these are things that are working as much as inconvenient as hard as they are. It is something that has been working and working a little bit better in regards to the pandemic. And like I said, it is a case where they've not had as many cases there. And, you know, I'll be blunt. When I'm not saying that there aren't good hospitals in Ireland. I'm not saying there's good medicine in Ireland. I'm not saying any of that stuff, but you know, compare that to the Mayo Clinic. And yet so it's kind of one of those things where it's a different standard there. So we have Dermot back there again. We lost Dermot.
Yeah, sorry, Matt, I don't know what happened there.
I can tell you what it is. Everyone's trying to call Ireland right now because it's it always is that way.
Yeah, well, I know that for a fact because I'm waiting for a little bit later. I have a call with Australia as well.
I was just talking a little bit. I mean, in Minnesota, of course, has got the Mayo Clinic. We've got the University of Minnesota Health System. We're known for medicine. It is amazing to me. I think that as hard as it is on that 5K radius thing, it does seem to be doing a lot better than we are here in Minnesota. And I think that even though I imagine a lot of people are frustrated over there, how are the people feeling about that these restrictions?
Well, I'm incredibly surprised how well people are reacting to it. I was expecting, when we first got the big lockdown, I was expecting a far more severe reaction, people not being happy. But most people have just accepted it, and it has to be done. I think it goes down again to the large proportion of our population that are over the age of 75. There is a strong feeling that they need to be protected and, you know, keep them as well as we can. And I'm very pleased with the way people have responded. But it does surprise me that we haven't had really protest in the streets of any serious nature, and we haven't had any objections from opposition parties. We've three main parties, as you know, in the country, and in politics, and they're all working together. They're ad idem. They're of the same mind in relation to this.
God forbid. God forbid.
Sorry, yeah. Even as I say it, I realize what I've just said.
Heaven forbid everyone works together and tries the betterment for all people here. How is Ireland doing comparatively to the rest of Europe, do you feel?
Look, it's in general terms, the reporting in Europe has changed. We're probably one of the last countries reporting COVID cases in relation to deaths and people who have had COVID-related deaths. In other words, they might have had some serious issues and had COVID as well as everything else. We still report those as a COVID death. So we look quite high. But I think in general, Germany's having a very hard time. UK has managed to get a lot of vaccinations out there, which is very good because they were having a very severe downward slope in relation to deaths and an upward slope in relation to infections. In all, since the start of the rollout of the vaccine, I'd say it's fairly similar across Europe. Obviously, we're a small country, we're an island, so it might be easier for us to control certain things like movements and lockdowns than it is for France or Spain or Germany. But in general terms, the news is getting better. That's the best way of putting it. The news is getting better.
Vaccinations, how are they doing over there?
Well, we're probably behind a lot. We have 450,000 approximately vaccinations gone out, of which only about 200,000 are the first phase of Pfizer. We're primarily using Pfizer. So the 98 or 99% of the vaccines we're using until are Pfizer. So we would only have, I think it's 165,000 people who are fully vaccinated, having, you know, the first and second injections, which means that for the general population to get down, for example, to me, I'm looking at probably August, September before I'd be in line even for the first vaccination. So in answer to your question, quite slow. I think until the Johnson & Johnson one, if that starts flowing in, we might see a speed up, but I wouldn't be overly optimistic of beating August, you know, September. I really wouldn't. I think that's about as well as we're going to do.
Wow.
I see America's doing very well, 100 million in the first, well, in not less than 100 days that Biden's there. And that's nice to see.
Especially, I mean, it can be done. I can imagine there is a lot of Herculean lifting going on. I mean, when they took over, by even the accounts of the Trump people that were still there, there was no vaccines, there was no distribution plan, there was no infrastructure to distribute. So the fact that we've gotten to this point, and it does help that the Johnson & Johnson vaccine came on the market fairly quickly after that. But yeah, it's been amazing because there's a lot of people that are working really hard right now to get everyone vaccinated here.
Yeah, no, it looks like it, and it's good news because, you know, in a kind of selfish way, if they can get America vaccinated past a critical point, well, then more vaccines will flow towards Europe, even though I think Pfizer is being produced in France now as well. I think generally, I don't matter how optimistic we get, we're probably all looking at the end of this year, you know, for life to return to some kind of normal.
I hope it does, because, you know, St. Patrick's Day over there is a wonderful celebration, and I imagine that's the hard part, is that you get to these moments, which are family moments.
I remember when we used to have conversations about the fun on Patrick's Day. Just happened? It was good. I promise you, it will be again. It's the same everywhere. You know, my wife's from London. Her mother has effectively been in her house for over a year now.
Wow.
They put a restriction on movements of anybody over 70, I think it was last April or May, and literally it meant shopping times were decreed, et cetera, and they didn't leave their home. I mean, that was almost curfew style. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's the same throughout the world. It's just been an... there's not a lot to talk about, is there, except what did you do yesterday? Oh, nothing, just like me. Good.
Yeah. Well, we do have some other things to talk about. I'm going to take a break right now. Dermot Flanagan joining us from Dublin, Ireland, outside of Dublin, Ireland. I want to talk about the final Brexit deal, how that affects Ireland, and then as well, I also want to get your thoughts on Joe Biden and the end of the Trump administration. Dermot Flanagan, our usual Irish visit on a St. Patrick's Day. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. Dermot Flanagan, kind enough to join us from right outside of Dublin, Ireland, as we visit with him, as we always do on St. Patrick's Day. And Dermot, I want to talk a little bit about the end of Brexit, because you and I last year talked about the mess that they had with Ireland, because there was a special agreement with the border with Northern Ireland there. And did they ever figure out what was the solution that they came up with?
Well, they came up with a solution was a border down the Irish Sea, which effectively said that goods going from the UK to Northern Ireland, because they had a possibility of going into the European Union across the border in Northern Ireland, they would be checked. And so there would be EU checkpoints in Northern Ireland or in the UK checking these goods going backwards and forwards. And that's just after falling. There was an agreement, a legally binding agreement, which approximately 3 weeks ago, is it 2 weeks ago now, Boris Johnson unilaterally pulled the UK out of. And so the EU are commencing legal action for breach of an international treaty. In fact, I watched an interview with the Richard, I can't think of his surname, but effectively the Biden's nominee for dealing with Northern Ireland affairs today. And he was saying he was quite shocked at the behavior of Britain, but there was still a chance for dialogue, etc. But the bottom line with Brexit is that 45% of Irish businesses still see UK as their major market. Now, that used to be 70%. It's 45% now. But in terms of looking inwards into Britain from Ireland, our biggest trading partners are the UK first, followed by the USA, then Germany, then France, and then China. So it's still UK at the top. And so it's very important for us that this is dealt with correctly. Now, that's the economic side of it. The political side of it is that this puts the Good Friday Agreement under threat. If they unilaterally undo what's been part of the Brexit deal, and I hope they don't, I hope they pull back, you are looking at the possibility of a return to an unstable Northern Ireland, an unstable Northern Ireland. There's no question of that. And we all remember, well, guys of my generation remember what that meant. But it is that close. I mean, one of the Ulster volunteer forces, which are basically a terrorist organization committed to stopping unification of Ireland, they've announced that they're withdrawing from the Good Friday Agreement, or their side agreement, saying they'll put down their arms because of this. And it all goes down to Boris Johnson. Boris Johnson is in a hell of a mess. Brexit, the true effects of Brexit have been covered by COVID. COVID has thrown us all into an artificial economy, an artificial world. We're fighting this pandemic, and the real economy has been put on hold. I mean, everyone's just throwing money at this, etc. So when that finishes, when we come out of the pandemic, the real issues of Brexit are going to come to the forefront again, the effect and impact it's having on trade in Britain. And a good way to distract from that from Boris Johnson, in my view, a good way to distract is to cause a little trouble in Northern Ireland. Mm-hmm. Nothing that detracts from home problems, like a little bit of jingoism. And that's exactly what he's doing in Northern Ireland. And I mean, you know, he's putting in danger decades of peace.
I want to make sure I understand this. So they initially had set this up to where basically Northern Ireland was, you know, even though it was part of the UK, was going to be considered kind of leaving the UK on trade. Now, and I know that the politicians in Northern Ireland, who are much more loyalists, I know that bothered them quite a bit. So is this new move just a way to try to for Boris Johnson to appeal to the politicians there?
Yeah, when Boris Johnson was brought in on a unionist vote, he didn't have the they brought down Theresa May and they backed Boris Johnson when he became prime minister. So he owes them. Mm-hmm. But it isn't as simple as they weren't being, you know, effectively kept in the EU through a back door. All this agreement was recognizing that, look, if Northern Ireland is part of the UK and therefore out of Europe, the European Union could not be seen to allow goods move from into Northern Ireland and then into Southern Ireland without being checked. But we couldn't put a border on the island of Ireland because we fought for a long time not to have that there.
Yes.
And the Good Friday Agreement, which was underwritten, of course, by the USA, it's they said, look, we will not have a border on Ireland. It's just going to cause trouble. So this in theory, if I can put it that way, idea was any goods to Northern Ireland would be checked either in the UK or as they arrive in Northern Ireland. It's not that difficult. You're talking about six counties, a very small piece of land. But in principle, the unionists are against it because they feel it puts one degree of separation between them and the UK. In principle, because in action it does not. And so therefore they object it. If Boris Johnson were to lose their support, his government could fall. But there's a massive hypocrisy in the whole Brexit movement. You might have heard of Jacob Rees-Mogg. He's one of the principal spokesmen and members of parliament with Boris Johnson.
Yes.
He's pro-Brexiteer. But before the Brexit vote, he moved all of his family's wealth to Ireland because he knew if it wasn't in the EU, he'd lose a fortune. And if you look, the majority of the Brexiteers, including Dyson. Do you have Dyson, that vacuum cleaner in America?
Yeah.
Famous. Yeah. Yeah. He's a Brexiteer, pro-Brexiteer, but he moved all of his business out of Britain while telling everybody else that Brexit was a good thing.
Well, and Britain is really, from the stories we're seeing here, Brexit's not going over too well with Britain. I mean, it really is looking like it's going to detrimentally impact that country.
They have left the biggest trading bloc in the world. 500. I mean, that's just a fact. 520 million people. And they've left it. And what they're saying is, you know, I still want to golf here, but I don't want to pay membership. And I want to use all your facilities. That's what they're saying. And when they realized that Europe weren't going to give them that, because they genuinely believed Europe was going to give them all the rights of a member without being a member. And now that they've realized it, and they've realized too, which I think is amazing, it took them so long, that there's a lot of countries around the world who maybe don't have as positive a view of them that even we have, you know, because, you know, India, well, they have a history with them.
Yeah, there's some skirmishes there that they probably still have to make up for. Yes.
Argentina, they were looking for a trade agreement with Argentina, expecting it to be, you know, an easy cakewalk. Well, they have a little bit of history in Argentina.
Argentina hates them.
You will.
Oh, know, yeah. Just,
and then America, who have, you know, I think quite rightly patted themselves on the back for the wonderful job they did in Northern Ireland. And Northern Ireland Treaty, the Good Friday Agreement, has tried to be copied throughout the world in many conflict zones. So I think they have a right to be proud of it. And Britain have kind of, you know, snubbed them and said, well, you know, thanks for all the work, but we're just going to throw it in the dirt now. So, you know, Americans have a right to be a little bit annoyed with them.
Well, and of course, we should bring up here that when Trump lost, I mean, Boris, he basically was desperately trying to get his pro-Trump guys out of the way because they were been very negative on Biden. You know, and so there's a little strain there between Biden and Johnson for sure.
Well, there is a little bit of a strain. He said some very negative things about Joe Biden, but he also said negative things about Trump. Boris Johnson is for himself and nobody else. He's not the brightest bulb in the chandelier.
Really,
but he's good at spending power. but you know, I just in case I come across, I'm not by any means anti-British because I do believe that. They are our biggest trading partners still. They are very like us in many ways. History aside, we need them. They need us. We've put ourselves forward as one of their best friends in Europe when it came to the Brexit deal and sacrificed a lot. We sacrificed a lot in that agreement on Brexit and Northern Ireland just to keep them happy. But every time, you know, you give an inch, they take a mile. Brexit's not a good idea. Not for anybody.
No.
It's not a good idea. It's no different than Texas secession. It just doesn't make sense, no matter how pretty it looks on a poster.
Yeah, keep your passport ready to go to Scotland.
Well, you see, this is the thing. The Scots are the next. Now, yeah. I personally would not like to see them break away from the Union, but the Scots have a right to be peeved. They voted to stay in Europe, and now they find themselves outside of Europe. It's only beginning to be felt, I guarantee you, after COVID is dealt with, because COVID has masked It's got us all working on a pandemic. It's masked the true horrors of Brexit.
Mm-hmm.
English cannot study abroad anymore without paying overwhelming fees. They're not subsidized by Europe. They're not entitled to what we call the Erasmus scheme, where all of us were allowed to go to a university anywhere in Europe for the same fees we were paying in our own country and have open access to the universities. It was a fantastic system. We still do it, but English can't do it anymore. And that's only one of the, there's research and development. Research and development is pouring out of the UK, because obviously if you're going to spend billions on research and development, you want to have it in that trading
room. Have it in the market, so yeah.
Yeah, I personally don't see it ending well. And not ending well doesn't help us, so I hope to God it does end well. Northern Ireland's a very dangerous one at the moment, but I do have a feeling that will be resolved, because I don't think the UK can afford to fall out with everyone, and I do believe that they have annoyed those people still around in the US who helped with the Good Friday Agreement.
Yeah.
And they're on both sides of the house, they're Republican and Democrats.
Well, and it brings up the Irish impression of America right now as our final topic on this, and that is that, you know, Biden wins. Biden has not been shy. He loves he loves Ireland. He loves the country there. I think a guy can choose between either England or Ireland, Biden's going to go with Ireland all day long. So I know that that's as well going to put some pressure on him. How does Ireland feel about Joe Biden?
Oh, they loved it. where his grandparents are from, two counties, Mayo and Louth, they have posters of Biden up on the murals on the side of walls, etc. They just loved the idea of him coming over as the president. He was well liked when he came over as vice president, but he's very well, very fond of him. So they are over here, and they love the idea of we always did, of having an Irish American president, not taking away from the fact that he's has to be America first, and we appreciate that. But it's great for us. It's great to think that somebody who went over, his grandparents went over, his great-grandparents, great-great-grandparents went over during the famine. It's great to see that, you know, he made it all. I mean, think about it. They went over during the famine when they were starving, and he's now president of the USA. If you look into his history, one side's family name is Blewitt, Blewitt. I'm surprised Trump didn't find that and just get on something like he blew it, you know. But anyway, he has to look into these things. But they were a very charitable and good Irish family that saved thousands of people during the famine, actually. But he's also, here's one for you. Google Rob Kearney, K-E-A-R-N-E-Y. He played rugby for Ireland, retired last year.
Yeah.
And he's a fifth cousin of Biden. When Ireland beat New Zealand in the USA at rugby, a Joe Biden texted him and said, "Well done, cousin." And when Biden won the presidency, Rob Kearney texted him and said, "Well done, cousin." So, you know, but that is a connection. And Rob Kearney is probably one of the best rugby players Ireland's ever produced. How Biden traced him back to be a cousin, I don't know, but it is true.
I got to imagine are there a lot of people sad to see Trump go over there?
my son wants a MAGA hat. He wants to wear it into school. And see
why? Why?
He just wants one. I said it to you about Trump a long time. We always avoided saying anything nasty about Trump because he was holding the office. And now that he's not holding the office, I don't know. He's like a caricature of a president. Someone, you know, you'd make a cartoon like about or something, like American Dad or something. What can you say about him except hopefully he goes off into the sunset and
doesn't. So long, yeah. Until he figures out he wants to build a golf course next year or something like that. Actually, he's probably going to be. Go ahead.
But when they found that walrus on the rock in Ireland, at first people thought it was Trump, but they just.
Nice. All right. We're going to end with that. Dermot Flanagan. Dermot, all my best to Helen and the kids. I love you guys. I miss you dearly. I'm hoping at some point here in the future you and I can see each other again.
Well, we were supposed to be there, obviously, just before COVID, and we couldn't fly, as you know. We couldn't fly in April. We couldn't. So as soon as it's over, we'll be going over.
All right. Well, definitely. I'd love to see you guys. Happy St. Patrick's Day, my friend.
Thanks for having me. Cheers, Matt.
My pleasure. Dermot Flanagan from Ireland, a lawyer. I'll put up his law office if you need a lawyer in Ireland. Dermot's the guy. He's right outside of Dublin, kind enough to join us on a happy St. Patrick's Day. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. Imagine what this country would be like if you had a 3-mile radius from your house you could go. That's it. I couldn't make it to the station. Well, I might be able to make it to the station from my house. Maybe.
I don't know if I could make it to any stores around me. I don't think I have any within 3 miles.
I got to tell you the truth. I'm a little, Ireland is very different. They have little stores in every one of these towns. But, you know, anything like a big shopping complex, which they do have over there, you might not have that within that 3 miles. That's, wow. Especially if you're some of the remote areas of, like, County Clare over the western side. Those are some pretty remote areas of the country. Wow. I mean, just imagine the person, the belly aching in this country, what that would be like under that. But
unbelievable what he said. Yeah, three political parties all working together.
How? Wow. Three, you say? Wow. We can't get two to do that. All right, so because with the remaining time here, I wanted to get to the Derek Chauvin trial. Total number of jurors temporarily shrank to 7 when Hennepin County Judge Peter Cahill removed 2 who said under his questioning that they had heard about the federal lawsuit settlement reached last week and admitted it affected their ability to assure Chauvin of his constitutional right to be presumed innocent during the course of the trial. That total was bumped back to 9 by the day's end when a black suburban father and an organizational consultant for her corporate clients were added to the panel. The case resumes Thursday at 8:30 with the judge granting additional preemptory strikes to both sides in light of the unexpected settlement being widely announced. Before questioning the recalled jurors Wednesday, Cahill began the court session by warning journalists against reporting what is on notes and in computers in courtroom, along with the security details of the 18th floor. He called it extremely irresponsible, said he would be sanctioned if those disclosures continued. One of the morning's dismissed jurors was a Hispanic man who in his 20s said news on the settlement kind of confirms opinions that I already have. I think it'll be hard for me to be impartial. The second excused juror, a white man in his 30s, said he was taken aback by the size of the settlement. It sent a message that the city of Minneapolis felt something was wrong, the man said. That sticker price shocked me. It kind of swayed me, yes. The remaining seated jurors questioned by Cahill were either not aware of the settlement or said it would not impact their opinions. A female juror who remained told the judge, I've been thinking about this question a lot. It wasn't surprising that the city made the settlement. Cahill asked the woman, a nonprofit healthcare executive in her 50s, how she would respond to a fellow juror bringing up the payout during the deliberations. She replied, I would say that has nothing to do with what we're discussing at this time. It's not part of the case. Prosecutor Steve Schleicher rose after the unusual jury recall to note that he detected some hesitancy on the woman's part when she affirmed her ability to judge the case without bias. We went through extensive questioning with her, I recall, Cahill said, referencing the woman's initial appearance as a jury candidate. I believe she can be fair and impartial. By the end of Wednesday, the 5 more jurors yet to be chosen before the live stream trial started in earnest. The panel consisted of 4 people of color and 5 people who are white, more specifically 1 multicultural woman in her 20s, 2 black men in their 30s, 1 black man in his 40s, a white woman in her 40s, 2 white women in their 50s, a white man in his 20s, and a white man in their 30s. Proceedings regained their normal cadence late Wednesday morning, with jurors coming in one by one for questioning. An 8th person joined the jury in the afternoon after promising that the settlement would have no influence on his ability to keep an open mind during the trial. A man, a married father who is black, offered a generally positive view of police, including when they investigated his home being burglarized, but he also feels that minorities are too often arrested. Most of them tend to be black people, he said. He said he disagrees with the concept of defunding the police as part of changing their practices, saying the police do a lot and would trust the police. He has a son who is nearing driving age. Schleicher asked him what he would tell his son if they do when he pulled over by police. You stop and answer the questions, he said. The newest juror is a white woman in her 40s who consults corporations big and small about how to improve their organizational and personal practices towards creating greater efficiency.
She said the settlement would have no bearing on her being a fair judge of the evidence. Civil suits don't often declare guilt, she says, for they are settled for different reasons. Should the payout come up in deliberations, she said that if it's not part of the evidence, then it's not something I would consider. Jury questioning started Wednesday with a man who was unemployed after a stint as a contractor and noted how being on the jury might stall his job search. However, he was hopeful about his prospects. He had a neutral view of Floyd and somewhat negative view of Chauvin because I knew that a guy died. I knew that Chauvin lost his job and was being put on trial. The defense attorney, Eric Nelson, moved along his typical script. He drew out the man on inclination to favor a law enforcement officer over a bystander when it comes to testifying credibility. If it's a topic related to law or law enforcement, sure, the man responded. Nelson then consulted briefly off the audible record with the judge, who then excused the man from jury duty. The midday break came with yet another juror dismissed. This one, a man who said he had many others he knows who are black have experienced prejudice at the hands of the Minneapolis police. Despite that, the man gave firm assurances that to the defense's repeated questions about whether he could be fair arbiter of the evidence. Me, as a black man, you see a lot of black men get killed and no one is held accountable for it, he said. And you wonder why. Maybe I will be in the courtroom, you know, to know why. The man, who previously lived near the intersection of 38th and Chicago, where Floyd was killed, said it's sad how the incident played out. It's another black man being murdered in police hands, he said. You get to the point where it's anger, but you have to sit and evaluate all the information. My opinion doesn't really matter. It's the matter with the judge and you guys, the attorneys, asked me to do. Nelson asked the man could envision Chauvin being acquitted if the evidence is there. Yes, sir. I could see that. Before being forced to use another preemptory strike, though, Nelson sought to have Cahill dismiss the man because of several remarks regarding his experience with Minneapolis officers, including the jury candidate references to Floyd being murdered and saying police would antagonize us in the area and play another One Bites the Dust when he lived at 38th in Chicago. What? Wait a second here. What? Saying police would antagonize us in the area and play another One Bites the Dust in the area of 38th in Chicago. What? The Minneapolis police, he is saying, the Minneapolis police go into areas where police have shot someone. And then play Another One Bites the Dust. What the? You know, you get the one guy on the jury who makes the comment that the police do a lot. And he's right. The police do a lot. But the Minneapolis police, there's a toxicity in that department, courtesy of the police union, which goes way beyond anything of decent normalcy. It's hard to comprehend how evil and mean and disgusting of human beings you have to be to where a police officer shoots an African-American man, and you apparently, as this guy is alleging, send police cars on out to play Another One Bites the Dust. You know, I said this the other day, and I'm actually starting to believe this more and more. When the police went down to that incident down in 38th in Chicago, and they came on out with their sirens blazing, all their lights going, trying to make as much noise and as much ruckus as they could. I said this, that's their gang colors. And the reality is I'm starting to realize I'm not too far off there, am I? I'm not too far off. If this is true, if the police are literally going into these communities and playing Another One Bites the Dust, how are they not just another gang? That's disturbing. That is disturbing. Schleicher opposed the motion, saying, I don't think the prospective juror reflecting his actual life experience reflected any actual bias. I think he was reflecting the reality he sees every day. Cahill denied the motion that the bench removed the man. The judge said he believes the man's introspection on learning why Floyd's death, explaining to the community the decisions he would make as a juror. What I'm relying on is listening to this juror was hearing, this is another black man murdered, yet he could be fair and impartial, and what they would get out of the way is the ability to tell people why. The judge noted the impact of the lawsuit settlement on jury questioning and granted the defense 3 more strikes and the prosecution 1 more. That leaves the defense with 6 remaining strikes after using 12. The prosecution now stands at 5 used and 5 at its disposal. The afternoon break came after an emotional woman said her daughter died by gun violence near the Floyd was killed. She was immediately dismissed. Wednesday afternoon, the impact of publicly about the case sank yet another jury candidate. For this man, it was a viral video he said he viewed numerous times in total, in part showing Chauvin's arrest of Floyd, or you mean killing of Floyd. In the juror questionnaire the man submitted before speaking to the court, the man noted that Floyd was intoxicated and using counterfeit currency before his detention, but there are no actions that should not bring out your death. There are many ways this could have been handled differently. To my knowledge, I don't know if they ever found a counterfeit bill. And to my knowledge, I do not believe he was intoxicated at the time. The man who lives in Minneapolis near the 3rd Precinct headquarters that was under assault during the rioting of Floyd's death, he went on to acknowledge he granted Chauvin a presumption of innocence would be difficult for me from what I've seen. Needless to say, it goes on and on. I will say this. One thing that he's talking about, let's step back for a quick second. Tomorrow, the judge is going to rule on whether or not the appeal again by the defense to include Floyd's past arrests in this trial, even though the police officers involved were not Derek Chauvin, and Derek Chauvin's on trial. So basically, and Cahill doesn't seem to be very interested in character assassinating George Floyd as a way to, because once again, what are you doing? I mean, you didn't know that at the time of the incident. Henceforth, all you're just trying to do is character assassinate him for the jury. And so I don't know if Cahill's going to allow that. We'll have to see. I'll be wildly disappointed. Friday, they are going to determine whether there's going to be a break, a time break, or if they're going to try to move it. I'm going to presume the fact that he has offered the defense 3 more strikes, the fact that they got up to 9 jurors again today, that they only need 5 more, especially if tomorrow, say they get up to 12 jurors tomorrow. So then all they need is the 2 alternates. If they get up to 12 jurors tomorrow, then what I my guess is going to be that the they're going to basically say there's not going to be a continuance. There's not going to be a movement, a change of venue. We're going to do it here because they've been able to find at least 12 jurors. So that the idea is over the next 2 weeks, they should be able to find 2 more. If today they came back and they couldn't find 1 more juror to add to the jury, then I think that the trial might be headed out of Minneapolis. This is wild speculation. I am not a legal expert. I don't know Cahill. I don't know the defense. But the fact that he gave those 3 more strikes to the defense team leads me to believe that that's leading me to believe this is going to stay in Hennepin County. So we'll have to see. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Let's take a break. Come on back. Your phone calls as well on a St. Patrick's Day edition of the show. It's the Matt McNeil Show on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. Someone tweeting here, just raising one brow. Just heard that Minneapolis cops would go near a place in George Floyd. I'm not saying that. That's the guy's story here. He's saying that's what would happen there. And if that allegation is true, holy God. Holy God, is that disturbing. there is a toxic interior to that Minneapolis Police Department that has to be cleaned up. And right now, because of the way the laws have been written, you know, it's the only way you're going to be able to do it is to shut it down and rebuild it again.
because the police union there has got way too much power. And so, yeah, I think that's the only way. I mean, at this point, I mean, if that story is true, if that story is true, what the guy said in the story in the Star Tribune, if that is true, my God. And if it is, I mean, if you've heard this yourself, you can call us 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. I want to make sure I read this. Make sure I'm very clear once again about how this is what put forward here. Pardon me. Here it is. Before being forced to use another preemptory strike, Nelson sought to have Cahill dismiss the man because of several remarks regarding his experience with Minneapolis police officers, including the jury candidate's references to Floyd being murdered, and some police would antagonize us in the area and play Another One Bites the Dust while he lived near 38th in Chicago. And I'm presuming that they're playing Another One Bites the Dust in regards to a shot and killed African-American. Dear Lord. Anyway, if that's true, wow. Minnesota's largest gas utility, CenterPoint Energy, has said the energy crisis caused by the February cold snap will see an extra $354 added to the bills in the state. Two things. One, that's bull crud. Two, the energy crisis was not caused by the February cold snap. The energy crisis was caused because Texas did not force their power companies to winterize their gas and oil and fuel lines. And because everything got shut down, well, that's their problem. Why are we? In a filing to the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission, CenterPoint says the extraordinary market conditions in February cost the company $500 million between February 12th and 22nd just to maintain the gas supply for its Minnesota customers. With the deep freeze also hitting states that are not used to it, such as Texas, Oklahoma, and Arkansas, the demand for gas for heating and electricity skyrocketed. Gas supplies also throttled by the shutdown of plants and production operations in the South, which were unable to withstand the frigid conditions. No, the companies didn't winterize them. Stop making freaking excuses. The corporate executives did not want to spend the money to winterize their energy system, and hence it failed. This is not our fault. The $500 million cost, it says, represents approximately 156% of the company's total gas costs during the entire prior gas year. As a result, the company says it needs to recover some of those costs from its 879,000 Minnesota customers at an average of $354 per customer, and that's before interest. Hey, I hope you enjoyed that stimulus check. By the way, has anyone ever thought put that two together? Look at this. We need to charge everyone in the state $354. Right at the same time, the federal government gave you $1,400. Well, you still have $1,000 left. $1,040-some left. There you go. A few bucks and some change. Why are we... No, can we put a tax on Texas? Seriously, can we put a tax on Texas? You can come here, so interstate commerce laws aren't going to be affected, but if you're from Texas, that's an extra, 50% tax on everything. You owe us. You do. Native Roots Radio up next. Have a good one. Till tomorrow. See ya.